Demonstrative with a summary of some evidence, I'll be referring to first page summary, second page, the cites to the record. I've given a copy to counsel and to your clerk if okay. if you would accept them.
Yeah, you can go ahead, Julie, if you would.
Time savers where we can find them, right?
Thank you. Okay, and do you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
I would, thank you. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Okay. All right, you can go ahead.
Thank you. Erica Turner on behalf of the appellant, Tipping Point Gaming. It was 15 days into a jury trial, 3 weeks of evidence, and the district court gutted Tipping Point's case with a Rule 50 judgment. You all know the standard, but it is to review the evidence and all inferences from the evidence in a light most favorable to Tipping Point and only enter judgment as a matter of law if no jury could enter a verdict in Tipping Point's favor. We don't have a written order, but we have a transcript. And if we review the transcript, there's clear error. There's erroneous statements of the law. There's improper weighing of the evidence. And we ask that the court, following de novo review, reverse the erroneous Rule 50 judgment, permit a new trial on Tipping Point's claims for the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, fraud, and business interference. And we ask that the court enter a written opinion on two important issues of Nevada law. One being that Nevada should recognize a sham exception to the litigation privilege, and it should adopt the Rock River case and its definition of sham exception. It's applicable here. It's narrow to a state law claim of...
Ms. Turner, would that chill parties from bringing lawsuits if they are in fear that they're going to be liable for intentional interference just by the act of exercising their right to file a lawsuit?
So we're not asking that there be permission of just the act of filing a lawsuit be subject to retaliation. That is the litigation privilege, but this court has accepted limitations, exceptions, where the purpose of the privilege is not being perpetuated. And here the sham exception, it's not enough that there be a meritless complaint. It must be a meritless complaint known to be false when it was filed, and this is critical, for anti-competitive purposes, for the purpose of interfering with a third-party contract. That is the ad that is critical and makes the sham exception important here. Sham exception is not something that's novel. If I were to walk into federal court in this district, instead of in conjunction with a compulsory counterclaim, in this state court, I would have the Rock River test that was adopted by the Ninth Circuit. And it would permit consideration of the sham exception. We have a gap in the law here. We can all agree that if Caesars had written a letter to the third party purchaser, or picked up the phone and called and said, here are some false statements about Tipping Point, and those false statements are communicated for the purpose of blowing up the deal, that's actionable interference. If Caesars were to file a complaint, attach it to a letter, and send that to the third party proposed purchaser, and it blows up the deal, under Jacobs versus Zadelson, that would also be actionable. Here we had where Caesars knew there was an offer and didn't know the identity of the party who wanted to purchase Tipping Point. There was a non-disclosure agreement, so they didn't know who it was. And we have an actual plot, a plan that is documented internally at Caesars, where on September 25th, 2017, you say, let's write a letter and we'll draft it in such a way that the other side, Tipping Point, has to provide it to the bidder. They knew that there would be due diligence, and that if you had a letter that raised an issue, a concocted issue, it would have to go to the third party purchaser and potentially blow up the deal.
Does the fact that this case survived summary judgment weigh against a finding that it was meritless?
The Rock River case actually addressed that very situation and said if the district court finds there's a genuine issue of material fact that prevents the court from making a legal determination on whether the complaint is meritless, then it goes to the jury. That's in the Rock River case, that very circumstance. And here, that's precisely what happened. The district court, when looking at the interference claim, did not look at any of the mountains of evidence regarding the intentions of Caesars to disrupt the potential sale or the conduct in furtherance of that interference that went on from September of 2017 all the way until the time the complaint was filed in early February 2018. The district,
don't we have other guardrails in place to address, you know, frivolous litigation, right? You can bring a motion under 18010 for attorney's fees. You can move to dismiss. I mean, I just don't know that we're prepared to adopt the sham exception. We haven't done so thus far. I think we do have other guardrails in place to protect against abusive litigation. Would you not agree with that?
So the claim is intentional interference. The fourth element is lack of privilege, and it is one aspect of the interference. All this evidence of interference and conduct to interfere, it is one aspect. The culmination of the interference was with the lawsuit. That's one fact point in a claim that really the facts of the case are square into the elements of an intentional interference claim. The only issue is one fact point is the culmination of all the intent and all the wrongful conduct was the filing of a complaint that was known to be false. And, you know, it was December of 2017. There's an email that was internal at Caesars saying Tipping Point's product is in hand tested, ready to pilot, and has the IP. And it was on the heels of that you have a complaint with those false allegations. And the only thing that differentiates that circumstance from, you know, attaching the complaint to a letter and sending it directly to the third party purchaser is they had to communicate through due diligence. They knew if they filed the complaint that it would kill the deal because it would have to. Nobody's going to buy a lawsuit where IP isn't clear. There was a cloud, and that was the culminating event. There can't be a gap in the law. Abusive process doesn't get us there because that is just using the legal process for an ulterior purpose. That isn't square within the facts of this case. And that I can go into federal court and get the sham exception and not get it in state court on the very same claim. There's a gap it cost Tipping Point $15 million.
Can I ask you about that with damages? There was a Dr. Lind who testified that TPG suffered. I don't know if that was the right expert, but there was a huge range between like 2.2 and some astronomically higher number. I think it was like 60 million or something. Is that range too broad? I mean, does that make the damages speculative in your mind?
So, Your Honor, there was no determination that it was speculative. Certainly, it doesn't have to be with mathematical certainty when you're talking about future losses. You had a range that could be argued as appropriate on the high end, inappropriate on the high end. That's something to be argued to the jury. But what you do have is evidence of damages with a range corroborated by Caesars' own internal valuations, where they said it was between 12.5 and 17 million in value just for the asset being developed under this contract. And you had a third party offeror saying, I'll pay you 15 million. So you do have some independent corroboration where it is not just swinging in the wind and coming up with numbers. There was a methodology that was used by Dr. Lind that was recognized, and Hallmark was not something that was an issue in this case. The witness passed Hallmark. So with respect to the damages, the court said you can't have consequential damages because there's a bar under the contract, and that was a clear error. There's a carve out in that contract for intentional conduct. So long as any jury said that there was fraud, intentional interference, or deliberate conduct in conjunction with the bad faith claim, there could be those consequential damages. And that brings me to the second issue, which is fraud. This court has slowly trickled the Giles prediction of the economic loss doctrine through its case holdings. Nevada needs a very clear statement that so long as a plaintiff meets the elements of an intentional tort, then the economic loss doctrine does not apply. That was the reason the fraud claim was dismissed as a matter of law, and it was just wrong. If the district court had looked at Rock Hill versus Bernard, they would have, the district court would have seen you can have separate theories, you can have a breach of contract, and you can have an independent claim for fraud during the performance of the contract. Fraud is its own claim that has a different standard of pleading, proof, and elements. And so long as you prove up those elements, then even if alleged in conjunction with breach of contract claims, alternative theories will be permitted. And under the Davis versus Beeling case, this court was very clear. You can have alternative claims with the same measure of damages. So when Dr. Lind said contract damages are X, then those damages, it's the same measure, whether it's breach of contract or some alternative theory. And Topaz versus Marsh, Clark versus Lubritz, the cases are all consistent. So we just need a clear statement. You prove up your tort, your intentional tort, economic loss doctrine has no application.
I think we already said that in Halcro, didn't we not? The intentional torts are not barred by the economic loss doctrine.
Well, in this case, the district court said because you have a breach of contract theory and the fraud is in the course of performance under that contract, that somehow takes us out of that that case holding, and it doesn't. It needs to be clear that it doesn't. With respect to the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, the court just was wrong and said, she weighed the evidence and said, this is breach of contract. But by doing that, the district court ignored what the actual elements for breach of the implied covenant are: deliberate conduct in contravention of the purpose, and that the evidence actually met those elements. It was improper weighing, and it was improper exclusion of an alternative theory. And in fact, there was no breach of an express term, but there was unequivocal evidence that the purpose of the contract was to have deployment of the product. Deployment, the ultimate purpose, was thwarted, delayed. Just one piece of evidence. You have this testimony from both sides. Yes, deployment was the purpose. Well, in September of 2017, there are actual internal emails at Caesar saying we don't want to give Tipping Point the upper hand of having these products in the field. They contacted the vendor that was responsible for the gaming lab testing required for certification and said, put the testing on hold. They did not tell tipping point they were doing this. They were concealing it, and they told the vendor, if Tipping Point contacts you, direct them to us. That is evidence that meets by itself. We get to a jury on breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, fraud. But the Jones versus Larry McGovern Bovis case, it says fraud in the performance of the contract and delay in performance. If you cause the other side delay, that's all bad faith. That's all breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And that never went to the jury. So all three claims need to go back for a new trial. And I have 16 seconds left, so I'll pass.
I'll add a minute to your time for rebuttal, and we'll add a minute to your time.
Thank you.
I know we had several questions. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Douglas Northup, along with my co-counsel, Debbie Leonard. We represent the Caesars entities. Caesars paid nearly $5 million for a product that Tipping Point claimed would be revolutionary. Unfortunately, and it was admitted at trial and in discovery, the product never performed and never met any of the success criteria set forth in the contract. None of them.
But would you agree that if there was evidence adduced, and I'm not adding any weight to the evidence, that there was an interference with the GLI certification by Caesars intentionally and seemingly surreptitiously, that would not in and of itself justify claims for fraud, intentional interference, intentional interference potentially as well, but breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, on that point, that argument was never made before Judge Alf. The argument that there was some GLI certification pulled late in the case was not made until the motion for new trial. And those types of arguments have to be made to the trial judge. But in that regard, Your Honor, Exhibit D to the master statement, the master contract here, lays out in detail what each party must do and what must not do in terms of deployment. And that's what the breach of contract claim was. That's what the fraud was. That's what the intentional interference was. It was all the same. And what they're trying to do is take a breach of contract claim and dress that up into something that it's not. But as to the GLI certification, again, that wasn't something that Judge Alf got to consider because it wasn't raised. And I understand the counsel was not at the trial or didn't get involved until the appeal. But that is a clear fact. And in this circumstance, the GLI certification was talked about was only for some games that Caesars was developing. Caesars could not and did not pull a certification from another party. They don't have that ability. They only pulled it as to some games that we're developing. And in fact, we learned in discovery that in February of 2018, February or March, that actually Tipping Point got part of the certification based on the GLI submissions that they now claim Caesars had some role in pulling. So that's wrong factually, but it's also wrong legally. And in this case, Your Honor, Judge Alf, the Rule 50 is an important gatekeeping function. Cases that don't meet legal standards shouldn't go to juries because juries get confused about all these different claims and things like that. And what this case was, and it went to the jury on competing breach of contract claims. And the jury said no to both.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Under that record, how is there an award of fees then?
Well, what Judge Alf did, because in this case, again, Caesar sued for $4.8 million, pretty straight up claim. He didn't perform. In response, it got nine claims, over $150 million in damages. And ultimately, this was under a fee provision that talked about the court shall determine the prevailing party in the action.
Right.
But the contract doesn't define action. So what the court did was look at the case law and in particular, this court's, the In Re City Center Construction and Lien Master Litigation, the term action includes the original claim and any cross claims, counterclaims, and third party claims. And what happened was this pretty straightforward breach of contract claim became this massive counterclaim. And as Judge Alf noted, that's what drove the case. That's what led
to the fees. They were already penalized for that, right? When they dismissed some of their counterclaims, there was already awarded for that.
As to those five counterclaims, but not the remainder of them. But ultimately, Judge Alf was faced with both parties saying we're the prevailing party. And how do you determine that? And that's why 18.010A doesn't directly apply because there's a fee provision. But she did look at Valley Electric. We've cited to the Hensley versus Eckerhart case, the Parati versus Bedetti case that we believe all support the idea. You have to look at the case as a whole, the action as a whole. And I think here, Judge Alf had little problem concluding that Caesars was the prevailing party and awarded the fees and costs. And
essentially, it seems like she said, neither of you won on any of your claims, but their claims were heavier, more weighty. So you're going to be the prevailing party. That's what she said, looking at it as a whole.
And different jurisdictions, I mean, for Arizona, for example, has a net winner rule that I think is consistent with this approach. Right. When you look at the action, it's not just, did you get a judgment? Did you get a judgment? Nobody did. Okay, to affect the party's intent, the court has to determine who's a prevailing party. And I think here, having lived this, those counterclaims is what this case was about.
The court doesn't have to determine that somebody is a prevailing party. The court can find that neither side is a prevailing party, correct?
Within its discretion, absolutely.
Well, but I mean, isn't that the presumption under Nevada law that each side bear their own fees and costs, right? That's where we start from.
It is in the absence of a fee provision, but here the parties had specifically said in Section 23K that they did want the court to award fees to the prevailing party.
To the prevailing party, but there has to be a prevailing party, which is I'm having a little bit of a hard time finding here.
Well, like I said, as the judge found and as we had argued and laid out in the briefing, when you looked at what the case was really about, you know, it wasn't just $4.8 million, but it was all these wide-ranging allegations and fraud and multiple millions of dollars and consequential damages and all that, that we think that the case law supports the notion that the judge acted appropriately in determining that Caesars was the prevailing party. And then ultimately
engaging in a vexatious litigation analysis here, which is more punitive than just being the prevailing party. But as you noted, there's a contract that simply states prevailing party, not necessarily triggering an 18010 analysis. And so, I'm just concerned because we may be chilling litigants from bringing, you know, good faith claims for fear that if I bring more claims on the other side, then we both lose, I'm going to have to bear the attorney's fees. I mean, you didn't win on your claims. They didn't win on their claims. It seems like a tie to me.
I see that, Your Honor, but I also understand that the parties bargain to say, if we get litigation, whether it's one claims or many claims, whoever loses is going to pay the prevailing party fees. And we respectfully submit that Judge Alf's determination was consistent with Nevada law and that she properly exercised her discretion in rendering the amount.
She ate our concern, however. If we start leaving it to judges to just say nobody won on any of their claims, but I think fraud is more important than breach of contract, so therefore you're going to be the prevailing party because they lost on a claim that I think is more important. And then you go to another judge that says, wow, breach of contract, that's much more important than a fraud kind of claim. So I'm going to say you win. I mean, it's just you're breeding some terrible inconsistency by saying nobody traditionally prevails on anything and judges are just going to kind of arbitrarily decide what claim they think is more important that somebody lost on.
I think courts do that all the time, though. In the sense of they have to look at the case before them.
Meaning courts are consistently inconsistent?
No. But I mean, they're put in a position of having to determine, and it's maybe a contract defines prevailing party. I've seen them that do that. This one didn't. So they're in a position where parties are saying, we both won, and they have to look at the case law and make a determination based on that case, who was a prevailing party. And as Judge Alf found, the weightier causes of action and what drove the litigation was the counterclaims.
Counsel, could you speak a little to the sham exception? It's a novel issue for us in terms of potentially adopting it. Could you just speak a little bit to and respond to what Ms. Pike Turner stated?
Your Honor, a couple things. I mean, the jurisprudence is long. It's a question of law for the court, as stated in Clark County. It's to be broadly construed and any doubt resolved in favor of application. You all know the standards, obviously. But there's no reason to adopt a sham litigation exception. Rule 11 exists. 18.010B, which is exactly the standard that the counsel is articulating, when the court finds a claim was brought or maintained without reasonable ground or to harass.
Well, but Rule 11 wouldn't allow a party to introduce, hey, they sued us and their lawsuit interfered with our contract, right? They wouldn't allow the party to introduce the fact of litigation.
Well, what's going on? I think they could, but here's the point. Even if the court were to adopt a sham litigation exception that citing to the North Pennington federal cases, the first question is that objectively groundless, meaning that no reasonable litigant could realistically believe it could prevail on the case. That's the Rule 11 standard. That's the 18.010 standard. And that's the first question. And what's so amazing about this particular case, Tipping Point moved for summary judgment on all of our claims during the case, and the judge denied them. She said they're legally founded and a jury could find for you. They moved not once, but twice at trial under Rule 50, and Judge Alf denied it. The idea that this claim was objectively baseless, we've cited a plethora of cases at pages 24 and 25 of our response where the courts say claims that survive summary judgment, because the standard, objectively baseless, essentially Rule 11, you have to be way better than that to survive summary judgment. And that's what the courts have said. And in fact, the Supreme Court case that counsel cited in their brief refused to find a case objectively baseless, even though the plaintiff there lost on summary judgment. So in this circumstance, there was no dispute that this case was objectively reasonable. There was no Rule 11 motion. There was no safe harbor letter. There was no 18.010 fee motion made. It was never alleged to be lacking in objective reasonableness. And that's why we're saying, if there's a case to think about adopting the exception, it's certainly not this one, because essentially what counsel's arguing is you have to not only survive all these motions, but you have to win. If you don't win, we get to sue you for fraud, intentional interference, whatever it is. That's the reason that the privilege exists, is to avoid that chilling that absolutely would apply if that's the rule, that you have to win. And a jury may disagree with your case, you still get sued for that. And so that's numerous reasons why the judge's ruling was correct, and there's no reason to change the decades of jurisprudence here. I'd like to address real quickly the fraud issue, because there's been focus on economic loss rule, but let's not forget the front and center argument was that the plaintiffs didn't prove damages. The argument that the contract damages are the same as the fraud damages was something that only the lawyers have said. There was no evidence in the case, and that was first raised in the Rule 50 argument. The 30B witness, Sam Johnson, said, I don't have any damages testimony. I rely on my expert. And the expert, this is Dr. Lin, from his trial testimony, questioned, your report contains no opinion on any damages caused by fraud. Is that right? That is correct. Question, and that's because you were unable to render an opinion based upon the documents that you reviewed. Is that right? Answer, that's correct. I was not provided at that time sufficient documents. They did not prove damages. Now, can you say, could there be a case where the fraud damages are the same as the breach of contract damages? That is possible, but that's not this case. And that's not the testimony of the witnesses in the case. It's lawyers only. It's only the lawyer's argument. Now, on the economic loss rule, because the court did apply the economic loss rule, the critical inquiry is whether the claim is based on a breach of a duty created by a contract or otherwise. And the Davis versus Bailing case talks about, even though the court didn't apply it there, the economic doctrine does not bar recovery of purely economic losses when the defendant intentionally breaches a duty that is imposed independently of the obligations arising from contract. And then holding there, the statutory claims were predicated on intentional breach of separate duties distinct from those arising from the party's contract. Here, the fraud was failing to deploy the contract, which was specifically addressed by the contract. And counsel admitted that when he argued at Rule 50. He said, our fraud claim, as it was identified from the witnesses that testified, and particularly from Mr. Johnson, is that Mr. Johnson continued to rely on the representations of Caesars that they would initiate deployment as was the original intent and actual express language of the contract. This is not an independent duty. And I understand this court has said fraud in the inducement is not subject to the economic loss rule. This is not a fraud in the inducement case. But here, the duty to deploy, the contract specified and governed that.
So again, there was no argument at the time of the Rule 50 motion about the GLI interference. I mean, I understand what you're saying now, but...
Yeah, that was not an argument that was made. And again, the contract says you know, none of the things that Tipping Point had to do, get the product license, had to be able to deploy it in a live casino environment, had to earn $7.26 per unit per day in additional winnings. Caesars never made a penny of additional revenue because it was never able to deploy this in a casino. So to say we're going to take Tipping Point admittedly failed to do any of those things to require deployment, but now we can avoid that. Arguing the same facts, but then say, well, you didn't deploy. You told us you were going to deploy. Let's call that fraud or let's call that intentional interference. That's the reason that the law is as it is. This was a breach of contract claim if it was anything. It was nothing more, and they failed to put to prove that case. Real quickly, on the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, because I know I'm about out of time. Tipping Point cites no case saying it can present the same facts and evidence supporting a breach of contract claim to a jury as an alternative to a breach of contract claim. We cited numerous cases which are universally to the contrary. The Stebbins case.
Sorry, I think you may have misspoken. You said a breach of contract as an alternative to a breach of contract. So I just want to.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Right.
As an covenant of good faith and fair dealing. As an alternative to breach of contract, you submit them both. And the Stebbins case, for example, where the contract terms are literally complied with, but one party deliberately contravenes the intention of the spirit, that's when you can get to covenant of good faith and fair dealing. But it says it's different from one for breach of contract because it requires literal compliance with the terms, and it's well established a claim alleging breach of the implied covenants of good faith and fair dealing. Did you have another minute, Your Honor?
Finish your thought.
Cannot be based on the same conduct establishing a separately pled breach of contract claim, granting a motion to dismiss. The 1600 East Newlands Drive summary judgment was granted. And here, what is really important is in the arguments, counsel said, our breach of the implied contract, we believe there's an argument they breached the contract by not complying with the deployment requirements. That's their breach of contract claim, right? So they want to pile all this on fraud, breach of contract, unjust enrichment, but the duty here was independent. And then lastly, they didn't have their expert do a calculation. What damages did you sustain as a result of this alleged breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing? He lumped contract damages together. And then finally, just really, really quickly on the consequential damages, the jury considered the breach of contract claim, and it's important to note, this is admitted in footnote 91 of Tipping Point's opening brief, consequential damages were only on the breach of contract claim. They were not on any of the other claims. The jury rejected Tipping Point's breach of contract claim on direct damages. They can't make a claim. There was no harm by saying, well, we should have put consequential damages to the jury. The jury decided that. That claim was incredibly speculative. The expert, in his own words, said those damages were uncertain. That's why consequential damages, that's why the range was $2.6 to $66.8 million. $64.2 million. That's how speculative they were.
All right, we've gone a little beyond the thought.
Yeah, okay, so we would just ask, they had their day in court, we'd ask that Your Honors affirm this judgment in all respects.
All right.
Thank you.
Julie, go ahead and add a minute and 45 seconds to Ms. Turner's time as well.
Thank you. So very briefly, this argument that there was no record of the GLI submissions being interfered with, that's belied by the record. Trial exhibits 286 and 2717 that are actually cited in the handout that I gave you were part of the trial record. And the Rule 50 arguments were just that, oral arguments. There was no specific reference to each exhibit number, but it goes back to what Rule 50 is. You look at all evidence and all the inferences from that evidence. And without a doubt, those were admitted exhibits. As to the argument that there was no evidence of damages, that is belied by the evidence and Nevada case law. Again, Topaz versus Marsh, the Clark versus Lubert case. You don't need an opinion on a separate measure of damages for each cause of action. It is enough to have admissible evidence of contract damages, and then you can argue that those same damages flow from the other legal theories. And with respect to the sham exception, that there's no reason to adopt it because we have Rule 11 and NRS 18.010. Those are not damages claims. Those go to an award of fees. I cannot get damages with writing a Rule 11 letter to opposing counsel. Intentional interference is a standalone legal theory resulting in damages. The $15 million that were blown when that deal was blown, those are damages for the intent and conduct, and the sham exception should be applied when you look at a meritless complaint. Summary judgment is not, that is just a procedural issue. The Rock River case goes in the analysis on why summary judgment does not defeat the objectively meritless point of the test. And the cases that were cited by Caesars relate to Rule 11 violations or circumstances where the party and tipping points in place, they didn't allege or introduce evidence showing that there was interference or intention to interfere with a third party's contract. That was missing, so summary judgment could be entered. Here, the evidence was there.
Counsel argued that the only claim that you all sought consequential damages on was the breach of the master agreement claim.
The record is belied by that. That was the only claim that went to the jury because it was the only claim permitted. And because the district court said any claim that requested consequential damages was barred by the contract. And that was a misreading of the contract because you had the exception for intentional misconduct.
Just to be clear, my reading of things was that you use the exact same language in seeking damages in the implied covenant claim as you did in the breach of the contract claim.
Yes, Your Honor. An element is deliberate conduct, and there can be a jury question. Was that deliberate conduct, intentional misconduct? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I appreciate your time today. The briefing was exceptional.